It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
For the right advice at the right time, give us a call and ask your questions of Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. Good morning, Cecil and Wes.
Good morning,
folks.
Good morning,
Ben.
Good
morning, Ben.
So what are we talking about today?
We're talking about duck weather out there.
Yeah, that's
I'm
right.
Telling you.
That's right.
Wes and I are here in the studio.
Yeah, I'm glad you swam in this morning.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Ben, last week we talked about some elder law issues, and I think that it would be nice to continue that subject this week. It's a complicated subject, and of course, one of the things that always is at the threshold of any elder law case is, you know, does the client have an up-to-date, durable power of attorney, or sometimes referred to as a financial power of attorney? Because, Ben, in a well-drafted power of attorney, the agent, the son, the daughter, the grandson, is going to have the authority to make transfers to a trust, be it an irrevocable trust or a revocable trust. They're going to have the authority to sign as on behalf of their loved one as the trustee. The power of attorney is also going to give them the right to make small gifts. All of these issues, there's three right there. Just the creation of the trust, the ability to sign on as trustee, as the agent, and the ability to make gifts. There's three powers right there that a well-drafted power of attorney needs to have. And so we've talked about this many times on the program. That really is sometimes the very first thing that we will do in a file,
right,
is to get the power of attorney up to date.
Which makes a lot of sense. We have a caller, I think, getting ready to stand by, or she's checking on it still, just to see.
Sure.
But that power of attorney, again, part of the triage or the trinity of documents that you want to have, right? The power of attorney, the will, and the healthcare power of attorney.
Right. The next thing, of course, that the client is going to be concerned about is the preservation, if you will, or the protection of the home place. And what is interesting here is that we can qualify an elder person for Medicaid, for long-term care benefit in a nursing facility with them still owning their home. There is a form that most DSS officers have their clients, their intake applicants sign, which is called an intent to return home. And this is a stated intention that the client will return home if ever able to return home.
Okay. All right, let's get back to that in a second. Coming to Mark in Swansboro with a question for us. Hey, Mark.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question for us?
I was wondering, I got a judgment against me about 25, 30 years ago, and I wondered, does it last forever, or somebody told me it's only good for every 7 years, and you have to go retake the judgment out. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yes, thanks for the call and the question, Mark. So was this a judgment in the state of North Carolina? Was it entered by a North Carolina court?
It was.
Have you gotten any kind of notice at all that there's been an application for it to be renewed? Anything like that?
No, sir.
So you said 25 years, is that right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, the statute of limitations on recovering on a judgment in North Carolina, unless it's renewed, is 10 years.
Ten years.
Right.
Okay.
So there could conceivably be an attempt to collect on the judgment, but you can certainly assert as a defense the statute of limitations, and any attempt to collect on that, given the fact that the 10 years is long since passed, is going to be unsuccessful based on the facts that you've given me.
If he's moved during that time, could they possibly have renewed it without him being notified directly if he didn't?
They could have filed a motion for the court to consider a renewal, but if he was not served with that, then it would be defective. So there would be a question about looking in the actual court file to see if he was given notice about that. I mean, that's just typical due process.
But could he be served by publication?
Yeah, he could, but they'd have to make an effort to serve him under Rule 4,
right,
all the other ways you can serve someone, and have to prove that they were unsuccessful in doing that in order to serve by publication.
Okay.
So assuming that this was not extended by motion before the court in order extending it, which that doesn't happen very often.
Oh, really?
First of all. It happens sometimes, and sometimes we need this office, we need to do that for folks. But still, assuming that it has not been extended, then the 10 years is run on that. Therefore, it's not collectible. You can't collect on that judgment.
So Mark, what you need to do is maybe this is just an assumption, and you already know this, and our listeners assume this, but you do need to go back to the genesis, the origin of where the judgment is. I mean, what county and what state, obviously North Carolina, but what county was this judgment originally docketed? And then
it was in Raleigh.
Okay, perfect. So that's Wake County, assuming that was Wake County. And then you go to the clerk's office there and have them pull this judgment so that you can look at it and you see whether or not there's been any renewal or activity on it after or slightly before the 10-year period. And then you go from there.
You're going to have to pull the entire court file.
Right.
And one that is that old may be archived. So you may have to contact them in advance and let them know that you're coming, maybe set an appointment, something like that.
Okay.
But you can look in the court file and see what has happened. Right. That's what Mr. Harbaugh
said. That's right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Mark.
All right, thank you.
I would think a lot of people would be afraid to think that they're going to trigger something if they go looking for it. No,
shouldn't be concerned about
that. He's not going to trigger anything because he is the, the debtor on the judgment. But he does need to know if it has been over the 10-year period, because if it has, as Wes just mentioned, it's unenforceable.
Okay. All right. We were talking about senior law issues, and we were talking about also the home place, about some of those things that are crucial to that. And you mentioned about the intent to return home if somebody may sign, and the ramifications of that.
Well, as I was saying, it's a little tricky initially, Ben, because most clients come in and their loved one has been told that your home is going to be just fine. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about that, Mr. Jones or Mrs. Jones. And the reason for this is because the home place is fine during the application process.
Right.
We can continue to own our home. It's not a disqualifying factor.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that there's a backstory. Mm-hmm. And the backstory is an important story in that once we do receive the benefit, the Medicaid benefit, the state of North Carolina is going to keep tally on that benefit. And then when our loved one dies and the home is in the estate of the applicant, they are going to seek estate recovery. They're going to try to be reimbursed for their for the amount that they paid.
Mm-hmm.
We yesterday had a letter actually on point exactly to what I'm talking about. We've had this file for many years now. It's an interesting one. I've not had a chance to tell Wes. We've probably been representing this daughter for about 15 years. And unfortunately, and she knows this, the home was trapped in the estate. It didn't get out. There was no pre-planning. And her mother went on Medicaid, and there has been this Medicaid lien attaching to the property. And we kept waiting and waiting for, as did she, to see if the state of North Carolina would in fact actually, if you will, begin some sort of procedure to foreclose, for lack of a better word, to perfect their reimbursement. Okay? That we know that they have it on the house, but how do they reduce that to money? Okay? And we got a letter yesterday that indicated that they may be starting to take some action to that effect. It was kind of vague, but that's the issue. The issue is if the house is still in the estate, the house, the land, the farm, any real property, then, of course, the state of North Carolina could very likely attempt to seek their reimbursement.
Well, I would think a lot of people that hear this, and the first thing they're thinking of, well, I better go ahead and give that property to my son before it gets too late, and you get that, and a lot of pros and cons to that.
Well, if you transfer the property to the son or the daughter, or to whomever you want to transfer it to, then that falls within the sanction period. You can't just give property away to become right. eligible for Medicaid benefits. Mm-hmm. So the sanction period is a 5-year look back. So, you know, if we can transfer the property and wait 5 years, then legally the state doesn't have the right to look back at it.
Mm-hmm.
But if, you know, we don't make it 5 years, 4 years before mom has to go into the facility or dad or whatever the case may be, then the entire tax value of that is going to be captured and brought back into the fold as it relates to the sanction. And there will be, depending on the value of the property, a period of months based on the value of the mm-hmm. the home where Medicaid won't pay anything. That's the sanction period.
And that's the big gamble if somebody goes that route. Yeah, but we hear it all the time.
Well, there are, we do, Ben. First of all, let's demystify a little bit more. It used to be 3 years. It's now 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We need to say that because a lot of listeners think 3 years. And it was 3 years for many years, but it's now 5 years.
Right.
The next thing, Ben, of course, is to transfer your home to your children, mm-hmm. to just deed it over, and to hope and pray that I don't have any problems for the next 5 years,
right.
Is risky at best.
Yes.
Because let's talk about that. When you put the title of your home in the name of your children, one child, two children, three children, we don't think about things that now our home is subject to the twists and the turns and the life events of their life.
Mm-hmm.
Suppose they have a significant creditor, one of your
right.
children.
Right.
Suppose they go through a divorce. Suppose that they have a bankruptcy mm-hmm. for whatever reason.
They become disabled.
They become disabled.
Yeah.
Any of those kinds of issues.
What if a child dies?
What yeah. if a child dies? Absolutely.
You know, I had one of those cases, you may recall,
yep.
Cecil, where what the person did is transfer mm-hmm. the property through a remainder interest to the son, the mm-hmm. beloved son,
right,
and held a life estate. Well, the beloved son had a heart attack and died.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was the beloved son's two children were drug addicts.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
So they got the property. So the effect would be, well, we can come back after.
Yeah, we'll come back after the break. But
yeah.
this could take you down a long twisting road here.
Right.
So,
have
but
to
there's
be
some ways.
With that.
There's some ways to avoid it, and it's, of course, we want to talk about that with Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, FM 107 at AM 1240. Of course, we're talking with Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, talking about estate matters there, too. And the Wes, you were going into where the look-back period is and then deeding over property and the risk you take, et cetera.
Right. So, you know, I was talking about the situation where many years ago, I had a client who transferred the remainder interest in their home to their beloved son and held a life estate. And basically that allows the mother to stay in the home, you know, and use it as her own. And then upon her death, it goes to the son. Well, the problem is that the son had a heart attack and he didn't have a will. So through intestacy, the remainder interest then passed through his estate to his two children who had serious dependency problems. And so he died.
And they didn't have to maintain that life estate?
No. Well, the mother's still living, so
right.
she's still living.
Right.
Okay. So she is very upset about the fact that this property is passing to the, you know, mm-hmm. these grandkids, who she thinks that the property is just going to get squandered away, which it eventually did. She has the right to live there, mm-hmm. obviously, until she passes away. But after maybe a year or so of my representing her, she did pass away. And there was nothing that could be done about the fact that the property then passed to grandkids who had
right.
who she didn't want it to go to.
Mm-hmm.
So by just conveying that property to your child, you've got a lot of implications with regard to that, and that's, you know, just one of many things that we've seen over the years. You
yeah.
have to be careful about.
Mm-hmm. That's just a few of them. There also are tax consequences, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
about, you know, an inter vivos, which means during your life transfer of your property to your children, you give them your very low tax basis in the property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you give their creditors the right to attach the property. You give them the right to talk about whether or not it's a marital asset in their divorce. They mm-hmm. die. They become disabled is one of the things you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
All of those kinds of issues. So what's the bottom line? The bottom line is to get it into a trust that is potentially ultimately for the benefit of the children, just like a last will and testament.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, even one of the children can be trustee of the trust, or a successor trustee, to just like an executor, to be
right.
able to sell the property when your loved one is no longer living and divide the property equally amongst the children. But so the children can be the beneficiaries of the trust, just as they would be mm-hmm. in a during life deed. But the bottom line is that the property is suspended, if you will, or placed over in kind of a holding pattern known as, you know, a trust.
The trust is a separate entity.
Yeah,
it has its own ID number, etc.
It does. It's a separate legal entity than we as an individual.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's many famous ones. You know, mm-hmm. Elvis's estate is an mm-hmm. example of one that makes money. So mm-hmm. the trust pays taxes.
Let's talk about that a minute. I'm glad you bring that up. I mean, Ben, Wes, and I do a lot of trust work. But trust is a very broad concept, mm-hmm. legal concept. There are all sorts of different types of trust serving all sorts of different types of objectives and purposes.
Mm-hmm.
There is not a one fit all mm-hmm. trust. That just does not exist. A trust by its nature is an entity that has been created by a settlor or a grantor for the benefit of another, which is known as the beneficiary,
mm-hmm.
and held for the benefit of another by the trustee. So there are usually three parties to a trust. There's the creator,
mm-hmm.
there's the trustee, and there's the beneficiary. We can have trust for minor children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can have trust for a handicapped child known as a supplemental needs trust. We can have trust for estate tax purposes, which is to mitigate estate tax. We can have trust to protect assets, which is kind of what we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
We can have trust to avoid the elective share of the surviving spouse.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We can have trust for the benefit of our children who are maybe fine. They're of adult age, but we don't think they quite need $1 million at age 25. We want to hold that back until they're 30, 35, and 40. I mean, the
special needs trust. Okay.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Special needs trust. So there are so many different types of trust.
Mm-hmm.
Some trusts are revocable. Some trusts are irrevocable. Some trusts do have federal ID numbers and need bank accounts and appropriate trust accounting. Other trusts, maybe we can avoid the federal mm-hmm. ID number. So it's a lot to talk about out there when you talk about the word trust.
All right. Well, more to come mm-hmm. in just a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins, attorneys at law, and I hope you'll stay around for more. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal with Harbell and Collins, attorneys at law. I have a question for you, Cecil, too.
Sure.
But when you're talking about the trust, at what point in your life, I mean, a lot of people thinking about it as somebody's getting sick, but at what point in your life should you be thinking about having a trust maybe ready to go or something like that?
Well, in terms of this kind of trust, an asset protection trust, we usually have folks in the office, you know, in their 50s, 60s, 70s. We, of course, have the folks who are, you know, grandmama went to the nursing home last week,
right?
You know, and left her home. And what do we do with it? We have those files, too, where it's imminent. But we have a lot of folks who are planning ahead, Ben. We really do. And let me tell you one that I think that it's interesting how the law and our substantive practice every day, every week follows sometimes what we read. We are having a lot of folks where it is the early onset of dementia. I mean, I just had a tragic file. It's a little, they actually were a friend of mine from high school, her, such a sweet girl, and I've always thought the world of her. She's only 59 or so. Her husband is the same, former, you know, very military guy, very athletic, also 59 or so, and he was in the office just last week, and he is, on his way, unfortunately, to some institutionalization. If you will, they just cannot manage him in the home. Wow, that's young.
Yes, yeah.
Unfortunately, physically fit guy. Yeah. I mean, that's young to be having advanced dementia, and yet he has that. I have other files in the lots of files like this, where one spouse is healthy, doing so very well, and they're 50, 60 year old. 65 year old, if you will, spouse is, in the advanced, stages of dementia. So we're seeing a lot of files like that. I had a lady in just yesterday. Her husband's a little bit older, but that's the dynamic that one spouse, the community spouse, which is the spouse that is healthy, staying in the home, but has their loved one, their spouse is significantly deteriorating. Now, these files are a real challenge for us legally, but we are able sometimes to move the pieces in square holes and round holes so as to get some positive result for these types of clients. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
No,
I kind of went
is.
around the curve to get it. But any, you know, better now than later, Ben.
Right.
Absolutely. No, we don't have many 30-year-olds in the office talking about asset protection trust.
Right.
What does the 30-year-old talk about? The 30-year-old, and Wes sees them every day of the week, you know, the 30-year-old is in there talking about my, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old child. And what if my wife and I go to the Bahamas and something happens and we're getting away from the kids for a nice long weekend? We need a trust for our minor children.
Okay.
Yeah.
Again, all of that is about planning so that you're not trying to put out the fire later, right? I mean, that's the whole thrust of basically our whole program.
Well, the situation Cecil was talking about just a moment ago where the folks didn't do the pre-planning. It was just a matter of setting up a relatively simple trust that all stays in the family, and then this house, this property that they have would not be subject to that Medicaid lien. But because that planning was not done in advance, the person did receive long-term care Medicaid, and Medicaid then has a legal right to put the lien on the property. So it's just a matter of knowing the law, knowing how it works, and structuring, using the law to your benefit, and structuring the property properly so that, you know, we avoid an unnecessary encumbrance or lien on our property.
Exactly. All right. If you want to find out more about what's going on with your own planning, you can check out the state of that and also make sure that it's done right by calling on the folks at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. You go to harvellandcollins.com. You can listen to past programs by subject matter, too, and also call them for an appointment at 726-9050.